in tomatoes and so on, but on your full line of vegetables, spuds, meat, and even fish. My sous chef uses his for just about everything. F. Dick makes a good one for about $25. It's stainless steel, but since it's serrated, it doesn't really matter. After a couple of years of use, if the teeth start to wear down, you just buy yourself another one. Knives are obvious. What other toys are in the professional's bag of tricks? Numero uno, the indispensable object in most chefs' shtick, is the simple plastic squeeze bottle. Maybe you've seen Bobby Flay on TV artfully drizzling sauce around a plate with one of these. The man's been making Mexican food look like haute cuisine for years with these things. Sure, it's just ancho pepper mayonnaise he's squirting all over that fish, but it looks like, well, abstract, man. No big deal acquiring these things. They're essentially the same objects you see at roadside hot dog stands loaded with mustard and ketchup. Mask the bottom of a plate with, say, an emulsified butter sauce, then run a couple of concentric rings of darker sauce, like demi-glace or roast pepper puree, around the plate. And pay attention here, folks. Now drag a toothpick through the rings or lines, and you'll see that all the fuss is about nothing. It should take you about half an hour of dicking around with a couple of squeeze bottles in your toothpick to grab the concept fully. This same gag is used by pastry chefs to swirl chocolate or raspberry sauce through crème anglaise and allows them to charge you another $3 a plate for 2 seconds of work that you could easily train a chimp to do. But chef, you say, how do they make the food so tall? How can I make my breast of chicken and mashed potatoes tower like a fully engorged priapus over my awed and cowering guests? The answer is yet another low-tech item, the metal ring. A thin metal ring or cut-down section of PVC pipe, about 1.5 to 2 inches tall and varying inches across, is the backbone of pretentious food presentation. Just spoon your mashed potatoes in here, or better, pipe the spuds in with a pastry bag, and you are in business. Just pile it high, slip off the collar, stack your vegetable, deposit your chicken on top of that, and you're halfway to making that fuzzy little emerald your bitch. Jam a gaufret potato into the mashed, maybe a sprig of fresh herb, or a nice pile of ultra-thin julienne of fried leeks that you've cut with your new global, and you're talking tall. Gaufret what? That's French for waffle cut. And what we're talking about here is a potato chip. You can do that. All you need is what's called a mandolin, a vertically held slicer with various blade settings. They make some very cheap, very effective ones in Japan these days, so it's not a major investment. One of these bad boys can help you make those slick-looking, perfectly uniform julienne and batonnet-cut veggies you thought they cut by hand last time you ate out. And it cranks out lovely waffle cuts with a twist of the wrist. Dauphinois potatoes cut to identical thickness, no sweat. You didn't think they actually cut those with a knife, did you? All right, the mandolin won't cut meat, and it certainly won't make paper-thin slices of prosciutto. You need a professional rotary cold-cut slicer for that, like they have at the deli. The home versions suck. But I highly recommend, if presenting sausage or meat on a buffet, that you slip the neighborhood deli guy a few bucks to slice what you need before you arrange it on platters. It makes all the difference in the world. Or if you have a few extra bucks, read the back of the paper for notices of restaurant auctions. As you've probably gathered by now, restaurants go out of business all the time and have to sell off their equipment quickly and cheaply before the marshals do it for them. I know people who buy whole restaurants this way, in what's called a turnkey operation, and in a business with a failure rate of over 60%, they often do very well. You can buy all sorts of professional quality stuff. I'd recommend pots and pans as a premium consideration if scavenging this way. Most of the ones sold for home use are dangerously flimsy, and the heavyweight equipment sold for serious home cooks is almost always overpriced. Stockpots, saucepans, thick-bottom sauté pans are nice things, even necessary things to have, and there's no reason to buy new and no reason to pay a lot. Just wait for that new tapas place on the corner to go out of business, then make your move. Let me stress that again. Heavyweight. A thin-bottom saucepan is useless for anything. I don't care if it's bonded with copper, hand-rubbed by virgins, or fashioned from the same material they built the stealth bomber out of. If you like scorched sauces, carbonized chicken, pasta that sticks to the bottom of the pot, burnt breadcrumbs, then be my guest. A proper sauté pan, for instance, should cause serious head injury if brought down hard against someone's skull. If you have any doubts about which will dent, the victim's head or your pan, then throw that pan right in the trash. A non-stick sauté pan is a thing of beauty. Crepes, omelets, a delicately brown fillet of fish or tender skate wing? You need a nice thick non-stick pan, and not one with a thin veneer of material that peels off after a few weeks. And when you buy a non-stick, treat it nice. Never wash it. Simply wipe it clean after each use and don't use metal in it. Use a wooden spoon or ceramic or non-metallic spatula to flip or toss whatever you're cooking in it. You don't want to scratch the surface. I don't want to oversimplify here. Obviously, if you have no sense of taste or texture, and no eye for color or presentation, hell, if you can't cook at all, then all the equipment in the world ain't going to help you. But if you can throw together a decent meal, can read a cookbook, well, then you can do a lot better if you spend some time playing with the toys I've mentioned. There are also some ingredients that separate food at home from food in a restaurant, stuff that we in a professional kitchen have on hand that you probably don't. And I'll tell you now which of these make all the difference in the world. Shallots. You almost never see this item in a home kitchen, but out in the world, they're an essential ingredient. Shallots are one of the things, a basic prep item in every mise en place, which make restaurant food taste different from your food. In my kitchen, we use nearly 20 pounds a day. You should always have some around for sauces, dressings, and sauté items. Butter. I don't care what they tell you they're putting or not putting in your food at your favorite restaurant. Chances are, you're eating a ton of butter. In a professional kitchen, it's always the first and last thing in the pan. We sauté in a mixture of butter and oil for that nice brown caramelized color. And we finish nearly every sauce with it. We call this monté au beurre. And that's why my sauce tastes richer and creamier and mellower than yours. Why it's got that nice, thick, opaque consistency. Believe me, there's a big crock of softened butter on almost every cook station, and it's getting a heavy workout. Margarine? That's not food. I can't believe it's not butter. I can. If you're planning on using margarine in anything, you can stop reading now because I won't be able to help you. Even the Italians, you know, those crafty Tuscans, spout off about getting away from butter and extol the glories of olive oil, and it is glorious, but pay a surprise visit to the kitchen of that 3-star northern Italian, and what's that they're sneaking into the pasta and the risotto, the veal chop? Could it be? Is it? Why, I can't believe it. Is butter. Roasted garlic. Garlic is divine. Few food items can taste so many distinct ways handled correctly. Misuse of garlic is a crime. Old garlic, burnt garlic, garlic cut too long ago, garlic that has been tragically smashed through one of those abominations, the garlic press, are all disgusting. Please, treat your garlic with respect. Sliver it for pasta, like you saw in Goodfellas. Don't burn it. Smash it with the flat of your knife blade, if you like, but don't put it through a press. I don't know what that junk is that squeezes out the end of those things, but it ain't garlic. And try roasting garlic. It gets mellow and sweeter if you roast it whole, still on the clove, to be squeezed out later when it's soft and brown. Try a Caesar dressing, for instance, with a mix of fresh raw garlic for bite and roasted for background, and you'll see what I mean. Nothing will permeate your food more irrevocably and irreparably than burnt or rancid garlic. Avoid at all costs that vile spew you see rotting in oil in screw-top jars. Too lazy to peel fresh? You don't deserve to eat garlic. Chiffonaded parsley. Big deal, right? Restaurants garnish their food. Why shouldn't you? And parsley tastes good, too. Just don't chop it in a machine, please. Dip the picked sprigs in cold water, shake off excess, allow to dry for a few minutes, and slice the stuff as thinly as you can with that sexy new chef's knife I inspired you to buy. I promise you, sprinkled over or around your plate, it'll give your chow that striking professional touch it's been missing. Stock. Stock is the backbone of good cooking. You need it, and you don't have it. I have the luxury of 30-quart stock pots, a willing prep crew, readily available bones, and plenty of refrigeration space. Does this mean you should subject your guests to a sauce made from nasty commercial bases or salty canned broth? Make stock already. It's easy. Just roast some bones, roast some vegetables, put them in a big pot with water, and reduce, and reduce, and reduce. Make a few months' worth, and when it's reduced enough, strain it and freeze it in small containers so you can pull it out from the freezer as needed. Life without stock is barely worth living, and you'll never attain demi-glace without it. Demi-glace. There are a lot of ways to make demi-glace, but I recommend you simply take your already reduced meat stock, add some red wine, toss in some shallots and fresh thyme and a bay leaf and peppercorns, and slowly, slowly simmer it and reduce it again until it coats a spoon. Strain. Freeze this stuff in an ice cube tray, pop out a cube or two as needed, and you are in business. You can rule the world. And remember, when making a sauce with demi-glace, don't forget to monté au beurre. Chervil, basil tops, chive sticks, mint tops, etc. What does it take, for Christ's sake? A nice sprig of chervil on top of your chicken breast. a healthy-looking basil top decorating your pasta, a few artfully scattered chive sticks over your fish, a mint top nestled in a dollop of whipped cream, maybe rubbing up against a single raspberry. Come on, get in the game here. It takes so little to elevate an otherwise ordinary-looking plate. You need zero talent to garnish food, so why not do it? And how about a sprig of fresh herb, thyme, or rosemary? You can use the part not needed for garnish to maybe actually flavor your food. That dried sawdust they sell in the cute little cans at the supermarket? You can throw that, along with the spice rack, right in the garbage. It all tastes like a stable floor. Use fresh. Good food is very often, even most often, simple food. Some of the best cuisine in the world, whole roasted fish Tuscan style, for instance, is a matter of 3 or 4 ingredients. Just make sure they're good ingredients, fresh ingredients, and then garnish them. How hard is that? Example. Here's a very popular dish I used to serve at a highly regarded 2-star joint in New York. I got $32 an order for it and could barely keep enough in stock. People liked it so much. Take one fish, a red snapper, striped bass, or dorade. Have your fish guy remove gills, guts, and scales and wash in cold water. Rub inside and out with kosher salt and crushed black pepper. Jam a clove of garlic, a slice of lemon, and a few sprigs of fresh herbs, say rosemary and thyme, into the cavity where the guts used to be. Place on a lightly oiled pan or foil and throw the fish into a very hot oven. Roast till crispy and cooked through. Drizzle a little basil oil over the plate, you know, the stuff you made with your blender and then put in your new squeeze bottle. Sprinkle with chiffonaded parsley, garnish with basil top. See? Owner's syndrome and other medical anomalies. To want to own a restaurant can be a strange and terrible affliction. What causes such a destructive urge in so many otherwise sensible people? Why would anyone who has worked hard, saved money, often been successful in other fields, want to pump their hard-earned cash down a hole that, statistically at least, will almost surely prove dry? Why venture into an industry with enormous fixed expenses, rent, electricity, gas, water, linen, maintenance, insurance, license fees, trash removal, etc., with a notoriously transient and unstable workforce and highly perishable inventory of assets? The chances of ever seeing a return on your investment are about 1 in 5. What insidious spongiform bacteria so riddles the brains of men and women that they stand there on the tracks watching the lights of the oncoming locomotive, knowing full well it will eventually run them over? After all these years in the business, I still don't know. The easy answer, of course, is ego. The classic example is the retired dentist who is always told he threw a great dinner party. "You should open a restaurant," his friends tell him, and our dentist believes them. He wants to get in the business, not to make money, not really, but to swan about the dining room signing dinner checks like Rick in Casablanca. And he'll have plenty of chance to sign dinner checks when the deadbeat friends who told him what a success he'd be in the restaurant business keep coming by looking for freebies. All these original geniuses will be more than happy to clog up the bar, sucking down free drinks, taking credit for this bold venture, until the place starts running into trouble, at which point they dematerialize, shaking their heads at their foolish dentist, who just didn't seem up to the job. Maybe the dentist is having a midlife crisis. He figures the bogey act will help pull the kind of chicks he could never get when he was yanking molars and scraping plaque. You see a lot of this ailment. Perfectly reasonable, even shrewd businessmen hitting their 50s, suddenly writing checks with their cock. And they are not entirely misguided in this. They probably will get laid. The restaurant business does have somewhat relaxed mores about casual sex. And there are a number of amiably round-heeled waitresses, most of them hopelessly untalented aspiring actresses, for whom sexual congress with older, less attractive guys is not entirely unfamiliar. Unsurprisingly, a retired dentist who starts a restaurant for the sex, or to be told he's marvelous, is totally unprepared for the realities of the business. He's completely blindsided when the place doesn't start making money immediately. Undercapitalized, uneducated about the arcane requirements of new grease traps, frequent refrigeration repairs, unforeseen equipment replacement, when business drops or fails to improve, he panics, starts looking for the quick fix. He thrashes around in an escalating state of agitation, tinkering with concept, menu, various marketing schemes. As the end draws near, these ideas are replaced by more immediately practical ones. Close on Sundays, cut back staff, shut down lunch. Naturally, as the operation becomes more schizophrenic, 1 week French, 1 week Italian, as the poor schmuck tries one thing after another, like a rat trying to escape a burning building, the already elusive dining public begins to detect the unmistakable odor of uncertainty, fear, and approaching death. And once that distinctive reek begins to waft into the dining room, He may as well lay out petri dishes of anthrax spores as bar snacks, because there is no way the joint is going to bounce back. It's remarkable how long some of these neophytes hang on after the clouds of doom gather around the place, paying for deliveries COD as if magic will happen. One good weekend, a good review, something will somehow save them. Like some unseen incubus, this evil cloud of failure can hang over a restaurant long after the operation has gone under, killing any who follow. The cumulative vibe of a history of failed restaurants can infect an address year after year, even in an otherwise bustling neighborhood. You can see it when passerby peer into the front window of the next operator. There's a scowl, a look of suspicion, as if they were afraid of contamination. Of course, there are many, many operators who do well in the restaurant business, who know what they're doing. They know from the get-go what they want, what they are capable of doing well, and exactly how much it's going to cost them at the outset. Most important, they have a fixed idea of how long they're willing to lose money before they pull the plug. Like professional gamblers, a slick restaurateur never changes his betting style. He doesn't bother with magic bullets, changing pricing strategies, or menu concepts. With steely resolve, a pro, in the face of adversity, will suck it up and redouble his efforts to make the restaurant what he wanted and planned it to be all along, hoping that the great unwashed will eventually discover it, trust it, learn to love it. These guys know that when you hit the panic button and call in the consultants, read unemployable chefs, failed restaurateurs who still like to eat for free, or start taking austerity measures like combining waiter-bartender functions on slow lunches, or worst of all, closing early, that they may as well close the doors for good. It's just good money after bad. A smart operator will, when he realizes things haven't worked out, fold up his tent and move on, before he's knocked out of the game for good. One disastrous restaurant venture can drag down an entire string of successful ones, as I have seen many times. These knuckleheads are even less easy to explain than the novice owner with a hard-on for Waitron Nookie. Proven operators, guys with two or three or even more thriving restaurants, guys who've already beaten the odds, who have had and still have successful money-making joints spitting out dough, what makes these guys overreach? Often, the original flagship operation is a simple, straightforward concept, a bar with decent food, or a simple country Italian restaurant, or a bistro loved for its lack of pretension. But success makes these guys feel invulnerable. They must be geniuses, right? They're making money in the restaurant business, so why not open a 300-seat interactive Tuscan restaurant takeout with merchandising outlet in a high-rent district? Or three more restaurants, maybe the Hamptons, Miami, the Seaport. Two frat bar saloons with two Chinese cooks and a large-breasted bartender as overheads have been racking in the dough, so why not open up a jazz club-themed restaurant in Times Square, a multi-story one with a three-star chef and live music? The answer is simple, because it's not what they're good at. Making money in the bar business? What's wrong with that? You're a lucky man. Stay in the goddamn bar business. Hang on to your money. I can't tell you how many times I've seen cunning, powerful, even wildly successful men fall victim to this kind of delusional power grab, this sudden urge to expand the empire, only to find their personal Stalingrad waiting for them. Some get away with it for a while, and though things aren't exactly rocket to the moon, they aren't going too badly either. The second place isn't losing money. It looks like it might even make money someday. So why not open two more at the same time? When they finally go to the well once too often, find themselves overextended, have to start ignoring the original operation, the one that made all the money for them in the first place, eventually bleeding it dry, next thing you know, the Russian tanks are rolling through the suburbs, misusing your womenfolk, and Mr. Restaurant Genius is holed up in the bunker, thinking about eating his gun. The most dangerous species of owner, however, a true menace to himself and others, is the one who gets into the business for love. Love for the song stylings of George Gershwin, always wanted a place where they could present the cabaret music they adore. Love for the regional cuisine of rural Mexico, and it'll be authentic, too, no frozen margaritas. Love of 18th-century French antiques. I need a restaurant so people can see them, see what good taste I have. Love for that great bogey film they have all that memorabilia from. These poor fools are the chum of the restaurant business, ground up and eaten before most people even know they were around. Other operators feed on these creatures, lying in wait for them to fold so they can take over their leases, buy their equipment, hire away their help. Purveyors see these guys coming, rarely extending more than a week's credit from the outset or demanding bill-to-bill payment. In fact, if you ever have any question about the viability of your operation, ask your fish purveyor. He probably knows better than you. You may be willing to take it in the neck for a few $100,000, but he isn't. He's got it all figured out as soon as he claps eyes on you and your ludicrous restaurant, exactly how much he's willing to get stiffed for when you suddenly throw in the towel. Chances are it's no more than a week's worth of product. Given these perils, why? Why would anyone want to do it? Inarguably, a successful restaurant demands that you live on the premises for the first few years, working 17-hour days with total involvement in every aspect of a complicated, cruel, and very fickle trade. You must be fluent in not only Spanish, but the Kabbalah-like intricacies of health codes, tax laws, fire department regulations, environmental protection laws, building code, occupational safety and health regs, fair hiring practices, zoning insurance, the vagaries and back-alley back-scratching of liquor licenses, the netherworld of trash removal, linen, grease disposal. And with every dime you've got tied up in your new place, suddenly the drains in your prep kitchen are backing up with raw sewage, pushing hundreds of gallons of impacted crap into your dining room, your coke-addled chef just called that Asian waitress who's working her way through law school a chink, which ensures your presence in court for the next 6 months, your bartender is giving away the bar to underage girls from Wontaw, any of whom could then crash Daddy's Buick into a busload of divinity students, putting your liquor license in peril, to say the least. The Ansel system could go off, shutting down your kitchen in the middle of a $10,000 night. There's the ongoing struggle with rodents and cockroaches, any one of which could crawl across the Tina Brown foretop in the middle of the dessert course. You just bought $10,000 worth of shrimp when the market was low, but the walk-in freezer just went on the fritz, and naturally it's a holiday weekend, so good luck getting a service call in time. The dishwasher just walked out after arguing with the busboy, and they need glasses now on table 7. Immigration is at the door for a surprise inspection of your kitchen's green cards. The produce guy wants a certified check or he's taking back the delivery. You didn't order enough napkins for the weekend, and is that the New York Times reviewer waiting for your hostess to stop flirting and notice her? I have met and worked for the one perfect animal in the restaurant jungle, a creature perfectly evolved for the requirements of surviving this cruel and unforgiving business, a guy who lives, breathes, and actually enjoys solving little problems like the ones above. He is a man who loves the restrictions, the technical minutiae, the puzzling mysteries of the life as things to be conquered, outwitted, subjugated. He rarely invests his own money, but he always makes money for his partners. He never goes anywhere and never does anything except what he's good at, which is running restaurants. He's good. He's so good that to this day, more than 10 years after I stopped working for the man, I still wake up every morning at 6:05, always before the alarm, and I'm never late to work. Why? Because to disappoint the man, not to live up to his shining example of total involvement would be, even now, treason to my trade. I became a real chef, meaning a person capable of organizing, operating, and most important, leading a kitchen, because of the man. He taught me everything really important I know about the business. He, more than anyone else I encountered in my professional life, transformed me from a bright but druggy fuck-up into a serious, capable, and responsible chef. He made me a leader, the combination of good guy, bad guy the job requires. He's the reason I am never off sick, go to sleep every night running tomorrow's prep lists and menus through my mind. He's also the reason I smoke 3 packs of cigarettes a day and know everything there is to know about everyone I work with. Why my purveyors cringe when they get my call, and why my wife has to remind me when I get home from work that she's my wife and not an employee. Let's call him Bigfoot. Bigfoot. I first met Bigfoot while still at CIA. He was then, and remains, a West Village legend, either loved or despised, and frequently both, by generations of bar customers, waiters, bartenders, cooks, chefs, and restaurant lifers. I won't give his name, though everyone below 14th Street who reads this will know who I'm talking about. He'll certainly know. He'll call me. "Hey, Flacco," he'll say. He calls me Flacco to this day. There was already a Tony working for him when he took me on, and as Bigfoot likes an organized operation, he needed a distinct name for me. "Flacco, I read your book." "Yes," I'll respond, waiting for the shoe to drop. "There's a typo on page 77, he'll say. "I don't know a lot about publishing, but it seems to me that maybe someone over there should know how to spell." Now, the first thing I heard about Bigfoot when I worked for him weekends back in the 70s was that he killed a guy. Whether this is true or not, I have no idea. Though I like to consider him a friend and mentor, we have never discussed it, and I have heard, over the years, so many versions from so many unreliable people that I can't vouch for the veracity of even that simple statement. But the point is that this was the first thing I heard about him, that he had killed a guy with his bare hands. And Bigfoot, as you might imagine, is big. As he likes to describe himself, a big, fat, balding, red-faced Jew boy, which is typically a less than completely fair description. Bigfoot is not an unattractive guy. He looks like an elongated Bruce Willis, but he is over 6'4", an ex-college basketball player, with enormous hands, strong shoulders and arms, and deceptively quizzical eyes. He likes to play dumb, loves to play dumb, and like a sunbathing crocodile, when he makes his move, it is way too late. "You know," he'd say, "I'm not a chef, and I don't know a lot about food or cooking, so I don't know how to make, say, guacamole." Then he'd shred my recipe and any illusions I might have about him not knowing anything about food, breaking down that preparation ingredient by ingredient, gram by gram, and showing how it could be done faster, better, cheaper. Of course he knew how to make guacamole. He knows to the atom how much of each ingredient goes in for how much eventual yield. He knows where to get the best avocados cheapest, how to ripen them, store them, sell them, merchandise them. He also knows how much fillet you get off every fish that swims, keeps a book on every cook who works for him with their individual yield averages for each and every fish they ever cut for him, so he knows, when Tony puts a knife to, say, a striped bass, exactly how many portions Tony is likely to get compared to the other cooks. Tony averages 62.5% usable yield on red snapper, and Mike averages 62.7, so maybe Mike should cut that fish. As an ex-jock, Bigfoot likes scrupulous stats. Cunning, manipulative, brilliant, mercurial, physically intimidating, even terrifying, a bully, a yenta, a sadist, and a mensch, Bigfoot is all those things. He's also the most stand-up guy I ever worked for. He inspires a strange and consuming loyalty. I try, in my kitchen, to be just like him. I want my cooks to have me inside their heads just like Bigfoot remains in mine. I want them to think that, like Bigfoot, when I look into their eyes, I see right into their very souls. My first night working for Bigfoot, a man I knew nothing of other than the rumor and the fact that everyone appeared terrified of him, I knocked a few hundred meals out of his cramped kitchen, finished the evening feeling discouraged, exhausted, and resigned never to work in his claustrophobic galley again. But the intercom at the bar rang as I was preparing to slink away, and the bartender gave me a curious look and told me, "Bigfoot wants you downstairs in the office." Downstairs in Bigfoot's lair, the big man looked up at me, complimented me on a fine job, and picking up the phone, summoned a waiter with two snifters of brandy. "We are pleased with the job you did for us this evening," he began. Bigfoot loves to use "we" when talking about the management of his restaurants, though in his domain there is never any "we." "And we'd like you to stay on with us, if that's agreeable. Saturday nights and Sunday brunches." I can't adequately describe the gratification I felt at having pleased the imposing Bigfoot. Though we quickly agreed that he'd be paying me only $40 a shift, I felt going home that night like a million. Bigfoot, you see, had purchased my soul for a snifter of Spanish brandy. I was not alone in handing over my soul to the man. He retained, among other deeply flawed outcasts, who'd inexplicably sworn loyalty oaths and joined up for the duration, a presidential guard of blue-uniformed porters whom he had personally trained in the manly arts of refrigeration repair, plumbing, basic metalwork, glazing, electrical repair, and maintenance. In addition to the usual tasks of cleaning, mopping, toilet plunging, and porter work, Bigfoot porters could lay tile, dig out a foundation, build you a lovely armoire, or restore a used reach-in refrigerator to factory specs. Nothing pissed off Bigfoot more than having to pay some high-priced specialist for a job he thought he should be able to do himself. One day I was sitting at the bar enjoying an after-work drink when Bigfoot approached and began giving me an uncharacteristic shoulder massage. I thought this a remarkably kind gesture, until he told me that his presidential guard was at that moment downstairs tackling the difficult problem of repairing a city-owned sewage pipe. The problem had occurred directly below our walk-in. In typical fashion, Bigfoot had induced his Mexican disciples to hammer straight down through 2 feet of concrete, then, like Colditz escapees, tunnel 25 feet through waste-sodden earth beneath the walk-in, and make a hard left turn to the site of the break. The big hands gently squeezing my shoulders were trying to determine whether I was thin enough to wriggle around the tight corner through mud and shit to help the porters, apparently too well-fed to fit. I couldn't hold it against him for trying. "That's not my job" was not in the Bigfoot phrase book. Toilet overflows while the chef is at hand, he's going right in with a plunger and fast. No waiting for the toilet guy, he is the toilet guy now. In Bigfoot's army, you fight for the cause anywhere you are needed. If it's slow in the kitchen, you pick an old saute pan and scrub the carbon off the bottom. Genteel sensibilities are unwelcome. Lead, follow, or get out of the way. I worked for Bigfoot part-time while I attended CIA, and years later, over 10 years later, I washed up on his shores again. It was a low point in my career. I was burnt out from my 5-year run in the restaurant netherworld as a not very good chef, in rehab for heroin, still doing cocaine, broke, and reduced to working brunches at a ridiculous mom-and-pop restaurant in Soho, where they served lion, tiger, hippopotamus, brujol, and other dead zoo animals. I was determined never to be a chef again, sickened by my last gargantuan operation, a 3-kitchen Italian place in the South Street Seaport, where I seemed to have spent most of my time as a convenient hatchet man, waking up every morning with the certain knowledge that today I'd be firing someone again. I was spent, desperate, unhappy, with a negligible to bad rep, in general, a person not to be hired or trusted, when Bigfoot called looking for someone to cook lunches at his new saloon bistro on 10th Street. We met, and I must have looked like a rhesus monkey, the one in the Perils of Freebase commercial, cornered up a tree, shunned by his monkey pals, exhibiting erratic, paranoid, and hostile behavior. I was rail thin, shaky, and the first thing I did was ask my old pal Bigfoot if he could lend me $25 until payday. Without hesitation, he reached in his pocket and lent me $200, a tremendous leap of faith on his part. Bigfoot hadn't laid eyes on me in over a decade. Looking at me and hearing the edited-for-television version of what I'd been up to in recent years, he must have had every reason to believe I'd disappear with the $2, spend it on crack, and never show up for my first shift. And if he'd given me the $25 instead of $200, that might well have happened. But as so often happens with Bigfoot, his trust was rewarded. I was so shaken by his baseless trust in me that such a cynical bastard as Bigfoot would make such a gesture that I determined I'd sooner gnaw my own fingers off, gouge my eyes out with a shellfish fork, rub shit in my hair, and run naked down 7th Avenue than ever betray that trust. There was order in my life again. In Bigfoot land, you showed up for work 15 minutes before your shift, period. 2 minutes late, you lose the shift and are sent home. If you're on the train and it looks like it's running late, you get off the train at the next stop, inform Bigfoot of your pending lateness, and then get back on the next train. It's okay to call Bigfoot and say, "Bigfoot, I was up all night smoking crack, sticking up liquor stores, drinking blood and worshipping Satan. I'm going to be a little late." That's acceptable, once in a very great while. But after showing up late, try saying, even if true, "Bigfoot, I was on the way to work and the president's limo crashed right next to me and I had to pull him out of the car, give him mouth to mouth, and like I saved the leader of the free world, man." You, my friend, are fired. I fondly recall how once, after a long-time waitress arrived back late from vacation, claiming her flight arrived 15 minutes after scheduled time, Bigfoot called the airport to check her story and then fired her for lying. Treating Bigfoot like an idiot was always a mistake. He lived for that. In the man's 3 or so decades in the life, he'd seen and heard every scam, every bullshit story, every trick, deception, ploy, and gag that ever existed or that a human mind could conceive, and was always happy to prove that to anyone foolish enough to try. If Bigfoot asked you a question and you didn't know the answer, he always preferred an "I don't know" to a long-winded series of qualified statements, speculations, and half-truths. You kept Bigfoot informed of your movements. He would never allow himself to fall victim to manager's syndrome, constantly watching the clock, wondering if and when his employees were going to show up. Where Bigfoot ruled, he knew when they were showing up. 15 minutes before start a shift, that's when. Bigfoot understood, as I came to understand, that character is far more important than skills or employment history. And he recognized character, good and bad, brilliantly. He understood and taught me that a guy who shows up every day on time, never calls in sick, and does what he said he was going to do, is less likely to fuck you in the end than a guy who has an incredible resume, but is less than reliable about arrival time. Skills can be taught. Character you either have or don't have. Bigfoot understood that there are two types of people in the world, those who do what they say they're going to do, and everyone else. He'd lift ex-junkie sleazeballs out of the gutter and turn them into trusted managers, guys who'd kill themselves rather than misuse one thin dime of Bigfoot receipts. He'd get Mexicans right off the boat, turn them into solid citizens with immigration lawyers, nice incomes, and steady employment. But if Bigfoot calls them at 4 in the morning, wanting them to put in a rooftop patio, they'd better be prepared to roll out of bed and get busy quarrying limestone. Purveyors hated his guts. They'd peel the labels off the cartons they delivered, out of fear that Bigfoot would simply cut out the middleman and order directly from the source. He was an expert in equipment. I recall him getting a leasing company to guarantee a certain number of cubic feet of ice production from a machine he was contracting for. 2 minutes after signing, he had his presidential guard measuring and weighing ice. When it turned out that the machine fell short by a few pounds or cubic feet, Bigfoot found himself with 2 new ice machines for the price of one. He loved playing purveyors against each other, driving the price down. Every once in a while, if a meat company, say, promised him the lowest price they could give, he'd have someone call him up, pretending to be their largest account, a 300-seat steakhouse, for instance, and ask for a copy of their last invoice as theirs had gone missing. Could they please fax another one? God help the poor meat guys if Peter Luger was paying 2 cents less a pound than Bigfoot was. Nothing made him happier than discovering fraud or deception or even a simple white lie. Once, after years of ordering frozen BG shrimp from a reputable seafood purveyor, Bigfoot discovered a hastily applied label indicating net weight. When it peeled off, he realized the company had, for years, been printing their own fake labels, heat-sealing them over the actual weight printed on the box, and cheating him out of a few ounces of shrimp every 5 pounds. Next time the company sent Bigfoot a bill, he simply sent them a Polaroid photo of the incriminating box, label peeling off to reveal actual weight, and the next time too. And for almost a year after, Bigfoot didn't pay for fish. He never discussed it with the company, and they never said a word. They just kept sending him free fish until they figured all that retroactive skim was paid back. When Bigfoot finally stopped ordering altogether, they didn't wonder why. Bigfoot paid his purveyors on time, religiously, a very unusual thing to do in a business where a restaurateur's real partners, more often than not, are the suppliers who send him food and material on credit. Given this, pity the poor soul who sent Bigfoot a second-best piece of swordfish. "What is it?" he'd tell him on the phone, playing the confused Dumbo for a while before the metal jaws clamped shut. "I don't pay quickly enough to get the good stuff. Is there something wrong with my business that you want to send me garbage? Or is it that I'm stupid? Maybe my stupidity makes you figure, well, that I want the kind of shit you send me. Or maybe I am stupid. Maybe I can't recognize fresh fish. Maybe this smelly piece of shit is really fresh, and I just can't recognize it. Maybe I've encouraged you somehow to inconvenience me and my customers. Maybe you could explain to me, because I'm having a problem, you know, figuring it out, because I'm so stupid. Or maybe you're just really, really, really rich guys, and you don't need my business at all. Things are going so well for you, and you figure you don't need the money." And he was always heroically willing to cut off his nose to spite his face. Who cares if he needed that fish delivery? If it arrived 5 minutes late, Bigfoot waited until the driver unloaded it, then he sent it back. I saw him do this with gigantic, multi-ton dry goods orders that were a bit late. And let me tell you, now I often do the same thing. Make the driver unload, then reload an entire order of canned goods, 35-pound flour sacks, peanut oils, juices, tomato paste, and bulk sugar, and I can assure you, your stuff will start arriving on time. Fish not what you wanted? Let the driver go, then call him up and make them send a second truck to pick it up. You say there's 20 servings of product in every box? There had better be, because Bigfoot's going to weigh it, count it, and record it every time. Bigfoot's entire office, the last time I worked for him, was a vault with an actual foot-thick titanium steel door, interior bars set into brick. From there he'd pore over invoices, plan his next moves, torment his purveyors, and send and receive emanations to and from the floor and kitchen. He didn't have to be on the floor all the time. The people who worked for Bigfoot were sure that he could sense what was going on. Think an evil thought, and he'd suddenly be there. Drop a tray, and Bigfoot appears. Running low on soup, Bigfoot somehow feels it, as if the entire restaurant were simply an extension of his central nervous system. A lot of his time was spent figuring out ways to make the restaurant run more efficiently, more smoothly, faster, and cheaper. And one of the earmarks of a Bigfoot operation is the tiny design features. The conveniently located hot water hose for bartenders to melt down their ice easily at the end of the night, into convenient drains, of course. The cute little plastic handles on any electric plug near any station where the workers' hands might be wet. And everything is always easy to clean and easy to store. Pots hang from overhead racks, always in the same place. Bottles at the bar are arranged in mirror image, radiating out from a central cash register. Careful consideration is taken with every tiny detail, from where employees store their shoes to custom-cut inserts for the steam table. I can still walk into a West Village bar and tell immediately if the bar manager is a graduate of Bigfoot University. The bottles are arranged in the classic pattern, free, but spicy, salty bar snacks are laid out, equidistant from one another, along a flawlessly clean, wiped, and polished bar. Ashtrays are always empty, and more than likely the juices are freshly squeezed. Bigfoot's presidential guard, in addition to their cleaning and tunneling duties, also squeezed cases of grapefruit, orange, and lemon juice every night, keeping them in appropriate storage containers, glass only, as approved by Bigfoot. Bigfoot's bar customers had every reason to love him. There was a house-approved buyback policy. Bartenders were chosen for their personalities as well as their ability. A television was always readily at hand, football pool a must, and Bigfoot made regular visits to the bar, handing out box seats to Knicks, Yankees, Giants, Jets, Mets, and Rangers, to favored customers. On Super Bowl Sunday, if you'd plunk down a C-note for the Super Bowl pool, drinks were free, and food was brought in from the 2nd Avenue Deli, a kosher smorgasbord replenished throughout the game. As one might imagine, living under the thumb of such a micromanaging control freak could be tough. Most downtime among employees was spent talking about, you guessed it, Bigfoot. Stories swapped, theories floated, gripes exchanged. But Bigfoot knew. He had a near supernatural sense of exactly when, at what precise moment, one of his employees had had enough. He could tell when the bullying, the relentless sarcasm, the constant, all-encompassing vigilance had become too exhausting. When one of his people was fed up with staying awake at night, anticipating his likes and dislikes, was sick of charting his mood swings, was tired of feeling demeaned and beaten down after being asked, for instance, to clean out the grease trap, was ready to burst into tears and quit, then suddenly Bigfoot would appear with courtside seats for a playoff game, a restaurant warm-up jacket given out only to most honored veterans, or a present for the wife or girlfriend, something thoughtful like a Movado watch. He always waited until the last possible second, when you were ready to shave your head, climb a tower, and start gunning down strangers, when you were ready to strip off your clothes and run barking into the street to scream to the world that you'd never, never, never again work for that manipulative Machiavellian psychopath. And he'd get you back on the team, often with a gesture as simple and inexpensive as a baseball cap or a T-shirt. The timing was what did it, that he knew. He knew just when to apply that well-timed pat on the back, the strangled and difficult for him, thank you for your good work, appreciation of your labors. And there was also the knowledge that Bigfoot could help you if you asked. Need an apartment? He could help. A dental emergency? No problem. Lawyer? He could hook you up with the best. Need a nice ride to the beach? Maybe Bigfoot could lend you his Corvette, which he never drove, or his vintage Caddy ragtop, which he never drove either. But his greatest gift was the Bigfoot system, which I use still. My inventory sheets, for example, are set up like the master's, in clockwise geographical order. Instead of hopping back and forth, counting and weighing vegetables alphabetically, or by type, like most sheets, I have my sheets laid out the way the food is laid out, allowing me to pass through my inventory in a comfortable, one-directional order, ticking off items. I know if an order has been called in, and if a particular item was, in fact, ordered. The telltale Bigfoot-style notations appear. Nothing is left to chance. I can tell a Bigfoot restaurant from the street. The waiters are in comfortable clothes, 100% cotton Oxfords or same-colored T-shirts, blue jeans or khakis, road-tested aprons for their order books, and multiple pens. God help you if you don't have a pen in Bigfoot land. The cooks are in restaurant-owned and washed whites. The porter is in telltale blue coveralls. The phone is always answered in the same way, whoever picks up. All pots and pans are scrubbed down to bare metal. I remember some in my time exploding in the dishwasher from metal fatigue, having been scraped down one time too many. No problem, Bigfoot will call the company and demand a free replacement. He remembers that lifetime guarantee. The most important and lasting lessons I learned from Bigfoot were about personnel and personnel management. That I have to know everything. That I should never be surprised. He taught me the value of a good, solid, and independently reporting intelligence network, providing regular and confirmable reports that can be verified and cross-checked with other sources. I need to know, you see, not just what's happening in my kitchen, but across the street as well. Is my saucier unhappy? Is the chef across the street ready to make a pass, maybe take him away from me at an inopportune moment? I need to know. Is the saucier across the street unhappy? Maybe he's available. I need to know that, too. Is the cute waitress who works Saturday night screwing my broiler man? Maybe they've got a scam running, food going out without dupes. I have to know everything, you see. What might happen, what could happen, what will happen. And I have to be prepared for it, whatever it is. Staff problems, delivery problems, technical difficulties with equipment. I have to anticipate and be ready, always with something up my sleeve, somebody in the pipeline. My penetration agent in the competition's kitchen is getting hinky about ratting out his chef. I need another agent in development just in case. Prior preparation prevents poor performance, as they say in the Army, and I always, always want to be ready, just like Bigfoot. I make my bones. Fresh out of CIA, I returned to the city for good. I actually knew a few things by now. During the 2-year culinary program, I'd been commuting to a weekend job at a busy West Village saloon, where I'd toiled away in a smoky, cockpit-sized kitchen, knocking out brunches and dinners. There had been 2 summers in Provincetown, which meant I was no longer completely useless on the line. In fact, when the chips were down and the window was filling up with dupes, I could actually keep my mouth shut and sling food. I had moves. My hands were getting nice and ugly, just like I'd wanted, and I was eager to rise in the world. On the strength of my diploma and my willingness to work for peanuts, I landed a job almost right away at the venerable New York institution, the Rainbow Room, high atop Rockefeller Center. It was my first experience of the real big time, one of the biggest, busiest, and best-known restaurants in the country. I was willing to do anything to prove myself, and when I got in that elevator to the 64th floor kitchen for the first time, I felt as if I was blasting off to the moon. The Rainbow Room at that time sat a little over 200. The Rainbow Grill sat about another 150. Add to that two lounges where food was available, and an entire floor of banquet rooms, all of it serviced simultaneously by a single central a la carte kitchen, and you had some major league volume, as well as some major league cooks to go along with it. The crew at the room was a rough bunch, a motley assortment of Puerto Ricans, Italians, Dominicans, Swiss, Americans, and a Basque or two. They were mostly older guys who'd worked in the hangar-sized kitchen forever, their jobs secured by a union whose only discernible benefits were guaranteed job security and an assured mediocrity of cuisine. These were some hard-case, full-grown, eight-cylinder bastards, none of whom cared about anything outside of their station. The room management worked them like rented mules. A long hot line of glowing flat tops ran along one wall, flames actually roaring back up into a firewall behind them. A few feet across, separated by a narrow trench-like workspace, ran an equally long stainless steel counter, much of which was taken up by a vast, open steam table, which was kept at a constant rolling boil. What the cooks had to contend with then was a long, uninterrupted slot with no air circulation, with nearly unbearable dry, radiant heat on one side and clouds of wet steam heat on the other. When I say unbearable, I mean they couldn't bear it. Cooks would regularly pass out on the line and have to be dragged off to recuperate, a commis taken over the station until the stricken chef de partie recovered. There was so much heat coming off those ranges, especially when the center rings were popped for direct fire, that the filters and the overhead hoods would often burst into flames, inspiring a somewhat comical scene as the overweight Italian chef would hurl himself down the narrow line with a fire extinguisher, bowling over the cooks and tripping as he hurried to put out the flames before the central Ansel system went off and filled the entire kitchen with fire suppressant foam. It was a madhouse. The cooks worked without dupes. The expediter, a just-off-the-boat Italian with an indecipherably thick accent, droned away constantly in an uninflected monotone through a microphone, calling out, presumably, orders and pickups. I can still hear him. Picking up one Avila Orloff and three Sol Balmorala, ordering 23 beef Wellington and 17 a chica for the Belvedere suite, ordering three Crispella Toscana Segway, two a steak, one a medium rare, one a medium. In the middle of 300 a la carte dinners, the cooks were required to crank out enormous sit-down banquets of fully plated appetizers and entrees for the private catering rooms, picking up a 500 the beef Wellington, and the whole line would break formation, drag long work tables to the center of the kitchen, and reform as a production line like you'd expect to see in an automobile assembly plant. Two cooks at one end of the table would slice and slap, others would pour sauce from giant long-spouted coffee pots, and two more would drop vegetables and garnish. At the other end of the table, a long line of bolero-jacketed waiters would then clap down silver plate covers, stack the entrees 10 or more at a clip onto serving trays, and ferry them like worker ants to the distant banquet rooms, only to return a few moments later. It was, as I've said, hot. 10 minutes into the shift, the cheap polyester whites we all wore would be soaked through with sweat, clinging to chest and back. All the cooks' necks and wrists were pink and inflamed with awful heat rashes. The end-of-shift clothing change in the room's fetid, septic locker rooms was a gruesome panorama of dermatological curiosities. One saw boils, pimples, ingrown hair, rashes, buboes, lesions, and skin rot of a severity and variety you'd expect to see in some jungle backwater. And the smell of 30 not very fastidious cooks, their sodden work boots and sneakers, armpits, cologne, fungal feet, rotten breath, and the ambient odor of moldering three-day-old uniforms, long-forgotten pilfered food stashes hidden in lockers to which the combination was unknown, all combined to form a noxious, penetrating cloud that followed you home and made you smell as if you'd been rolling around in sheep guts. The atmosphere was not unlike a Pinheiro play, very jailhouse with a lot of grab-ass, heated argument, hyper-macho posturing, and drunken ranting. Two burly men who just as soon kill you as look at you when talking to each other would often nestle a hand tenderly next to the testicles of the other as if to say, I am so not gay, I can even do this. The common language was a mix of Nueva Yorkeño Spanish, Italian, and Pidgin English. The Spanish and Italians, as is often the case, had no problem understanding each other, but when speaking English, one had to conform to the style book. One didn't say, that's my knife, one said instead, is for me, the knife. My own personal tormentor for the first few weeks was the chef de garde-manger and shop steward, a big ugly Puerto Rican with a ruined face named Luis. Luis considered frequent explorations of my young ass with his dirty paws to be a perk of his exalted position. At every opportunity, he'd take a running swat between my cheeks, driving his fingers as far up my ass as my checked pants would allow. I endured this in the spirit of good fun for a while, until I'd had enough. There was a lot of ass-grabbing and ball-fondling going on after all, and I did want desperately to be one of the guys. But Luisa generally knocked off a half a fifth of cooking brandy by 10 each morning, and as his drunken advances threatened to become actual penetration, I was moved to take drastic action. I was making filling for Crispella Toscana in the huge tilting brazier one morning, stirring mushrooms, diced tongue, ham, turkey, spinach, and bechamel, with a big heavyweight curved Dexter meat fork, a nice patina of rust on its blunt and twisted tines. Out of the corner of my eye, I could see Luis coming, his right hand swinging back for a deep wallop between my cheeks. I decided right then I'd had enough. I was going to straighten this drunken pig out. I quickly, but subtly, turned the big meat fork around and down so the business end was pointing backwards. I timed my move for maximum impact. When Luis came in with his hand, I came down with the fork as hard as I could, sinking both tines deep into his knuckles with a satisfying crunch. Luis screamed like a burning wolverine and fell to his knees, two wide holes, one on each side of his middle knuckle, already welling up with blood. He managed to get up, the whole kitchen crew screaming and hooting with laughter, his hand blowing up to the size of a catcher's mitt, and taking on an interesting black and blue and red color. After a visit to one of the fine union-sponsored medical clinics, the hand was even larger, looking like a gauze-wrapped football and leaking yellow antiseptic. My life improved immediately. The other cooks began addressing me as an equal. Nobody grabbed my ass anymore. People smiled and patted me on the back when I came to work in the morning. I had made my bones. My job at the room initially was to prepare and serve a lunch buffet for about 100 or so regular members of the Rockefeller Center Luncheon Club, mostly geriatric business types from the building who had assembled in the Rainbow Grill every day. I had to prepare a cold buffet and two hot entrees, which I'd then serve and maintain from noon to 3. This was no easy feat, as the buffet was comprised solely of leftovers from the previous night's service. I'd begin each morning at 7:30, pushing a little cart with wobbly casters down the line, where the cooks would hurl hunks of roast pork, end cuts, crocks of cooked beans, overcooked pasta, blanched vegetables, and remnants of sauces at me. My job was to find a way to make all this look edible. I have to say I did pretty well, using every dirty trick I'd learned at CIA. I turned leftover steaks into, say, salade de bœuf en vinaigrette, transformed dead pasta and veggies into festive pasta salads, made elaborately aspicked and decorated trays out of sliced leftover roast. I made mousses, pâtés, galantines, and every other thing I could think of to turn the scrapings into something our aged but wealthy clientele would gum down without complaint. And then, of course, I'd don a clean jacket and apron, cram one of those silly coffee filter-like chef's hats on my head, and stand by a voiture slicing and serving the hot entrees. "Would you care for some tongue en madère?" I'd ask through clenched teeth, my face a rictus of faux cheer as I'd have to repeat and repeat for the hard-of-hearing captains of industry who ate the same spread of sauce-disguised leftovers every lunch, and for whom the hot entree was clearly the highlight of their day. "Boiled beef with horseradish sauce, sir?" I'd chirp. "And would you care for a steamed potato with that?" The Irish waitresses who worked the luncheon club with me were more like nurses after years of this. They had nicknames for our regulars, Dribbling Dick for one 90-year-old who had a hard time keeping his food in his mouth, Stinky for an apparently incontinent banker, Shaky Pete for the guy who needed his food cut for him, and so on. There were famous names in banking and industry with us every day, all New York laid out below us beyond the floor-to-ceiling picture windows, eating garbage at the top of the world. Since shanking Luis, I'd been increasingly considered to be a person of substance. The chef, an affable blue-eyed Italian named Quinto, now felt free to take full advantage of my youth, my resilience, and my willingness to work for minimum wage. After coming in at 7, taking care of my retirement village upstairs in the club, breaking down the buffet and saving what I could reuse for tomorrow, I was now regularly called on to stick around and help prep for the massive nighttime banquets and cocktail parties. Absenteeism being rampant in our little corner of the workers' paradise, Local 6, I was taken aside more and more at the last minute and asked to remain until midnight, filling in on the hotline. I worked grill station, sauté, fish station, at first only as a commis, hunting and fetching, covering the cooks on breaks, reloading reach-ins, straining sauces, mopping brows, running numbers to the house bookie, collecting bets, and so on. But in no time I was working stations alone, and keeping up my end nicely. I made thousands and thousands of baby quiches for parties and gristly little kebabs from the tough, nearly inedible chain that runs along the side of the beef tenderloin. I peeled 75 pounds of shrimp at a clip, seared Wellingtons, made chicken liver mousse, our version of foie gras, and in the course of my labors as General Dog's Body, got to know the far recesses and dark corners of the vast room facilities. I also got to know the heavy hitters, the silent butcher and his assistant, the mercurial baby-faced chef pâtissier, the doomed-looking knight saucier, and most memorably Juan, the 60-ish day broiler man, a fierce trash-talking Basque, who I swear I saw one time sewing up a very bad knife wound on his hand right on the line, with a sewing needle and thread muttering all the while as he pushed through the flaps of skin with the point, "I am a tough skronk, motherfucker skronk. I am a tough son of bitch skronk. I am a tough mother skronk fucker." Juan was also famous for allegedly following up a bad finger wound with a self-inflicted amputation. After catching a finger in an oven door, he had consulted the union benefit list for amount given for victims of partial amputation and decided to cash in by lopping off the dangling portion. Whether this story was true or not mattered little to me. It was entirely believable after getting to know Juan. He may have been over 60, but he lifted stockpots without help, wielded the largest knife I'd ever seen, and generally kicked more ass more quickly than any of the younger cooks. There was a procession of Swiss, Austrian, and American sous chefs, none of whom lasted for more than a few weeks. They were quickly discouraged by our veteran crew from even attempting to impose order or quality control or change of any kind. The lifers like Juan and Luis would tell these eager young neophytes to go fuck themselves right to their faces. The intractable underlings who looked to them as role models would simply feign agreement and then do what they'd always done anyway. Short of murder, you really couldn't be fired. One beefy German sous chef, after taking more than his share of lip from a lowly commis named Mosquito, had the poor judgment to grab him by the throat, lift him off the floor, and shake him. The ensuing storm brought in the mustache peaks from the local, two sinister-looking guys in long coats who'd show up to settle disputes. Sous chef, commis, chef, and all holed up in a room for half an hour, after which the sous emerged, tail between his legs, and suitably apologetic, having found out who the bosses really were. Like all his predecessors, he disappeared soon after. I began to move more freely through the halls, back stairways, offices, dining, and storage areas of the Rainbow Room. I made an interesting discovery. There was, in an unused area, a narrow passage through stacked tables where employees could actually crawl out an open window. On my union-mandated 15-minute breaks, I would sit out on a narrow precipice, 64 flights up, my legs dangling over the edge, one arm wrapped around a sash, smoking weed with the dishwashers. Central Park and Upper Manhattan splayed out before me. The observation deck on the roof was open as well for a little mid-shift sunbathing. If you looked carefully, there were other perks. There was a healthy sports book up and running, and side bets aplenty. When a Panamanian and a Dominican were duking it out for the world middleweight title, there was always an employee willing to bet big bucks along national pride lines, whatever the Vegas odds were. A Puerto Rican has a hard time betting on a boxer from Ecuador, even if he's heavily favored. Sensibly, however, I buy a case of beer for the whole crew with a portion of my winnings, so there never was any ill will. Many of the Spanish-speaking members of the crew took part in an unusual banking scheme where each week all the members of a large group would sign over all their paychecks to one guy. The recipient was selected on a rotating basis, and the way it worked, I gathered, was that for about 2 months or so, everybody squeaked by, doing their best to make do without a check, spending little, until the day it was their turn, at which point they came into thousands of dollars and would spend like drunken sailors. This practice made no sense to me. It also required an extraordinary amount of trust in one's fellow cooks. I did not share my comrade's confidence that Luis, for instance, wouldn't skip town on a drunk after getting his big payday and leave the others in the lurch. I held on to my meager paycheck. I had no time to spend it anyway. One foggy night around 10, with only a few customers left in the main dining room, an electric current seemed to run through the floor staff. There was a sudden gang rush to the upstairs bus station, where one could just barely see and hear what was going on in the room. "Frank is here! Frank is here!" was the battle cry. Even the cooks abandoned their stations to see what the commotion was about. Sure enough, the man himself had come to dinner. Frank Sinatra was in the house, and he was singing. Sinatra had swung by with a posse of thick-necked pals, ordered up some bottles and snacks, and now, backed by the house orchestra, was belting out tunes to an awestruck audience of about 20 customers who had been lucky enough to linger over dessert. These few tourists, who up to now must have been bemoaning the bad weather, the lack of visibility ruining the famous view, the empty dining room, and the miserable food, were suddenly the luckiest bastards in New York. Sinatra, having a good time apparently, sang for quite a while. He was still there when I knocked off work. Other celebrity sightings included a well-known member of a Sicilian fraternal organization in the entertainment and financial services sector who made an impromptu visit to the kitchen for a few words with our kindly Neapolitan chef. I saw a 50 go in a poor Quinto's chest pocket with an affectionate slap on the cheek. Now the hapless bastard was committing to making gnocchi Genovese like I used to get. Gnocchi Genovese was not on our regular menu, and I doubt that the chef had actually cooked anything, much less gnocchi and meat sauce, from scratch in years. Quinto was more like an air traffic controller than a cook, but he'd taken the man's money, not that he'd had a choice, and he spent the next hour in the middle of a busy dinner service spooning batch after batch.